Yeah. So, really, beginning tonight, till tonight is the beginning of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz. The fast is, being a minor fast, is observed only during the day. So the fast is observed tomorrow from daybreak until nightfall. And actually, the reason is the background with the fast is the fast is actually has its source in the prophet Zechariah, who calls it the fast of the fourth and the fifth. So Shiva Asar B'Tammuz is actually the fast of the fourth month. And the rule is, the Talmud says, in a time of existential persecution, so actually those what we consider minor fasts, Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, Tzom Gedaliah, the 10th of Tevis, would actually be full-day fasts with all the restrictions of Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur. But in a time where there's not necessarily, you know, more of an existential threat, so then we observe these fasts as a strong custom, which the Jews have accepted upon themselves to observe. So that's really the status of the fast, and it's why we, on the 17th of Tammuz, only observe a half-day fast. But I figured since we're approaching the date of the 17th of Tammuz and the fast, and then the 3 weeks between Shiva Asar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, at least in the current situation, is currently a period of mourning. And while, you know, we're probably familiar with some of the mourning customs that are practiced during this period, whether listening to music or getting haircuts, I think it's important to fully appreciate what exactly we're commemorating during this period and what exactly we're mourning. So the first question is, we're about to approach Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. So what happened on the 17th of Tammuz? Why are we fasting? If you need a hint, there's a hint right here. The Mishnah says that there were actually five tragedies that happened to our ancestors on the 17th of Tammuz. There's a myth. The breach of the, so Debbie said the breach of the walls. In the period of both the first and the second temples, both of them were actually destroyed on the 9th of Av. In the first temple, the walls were actually breached on the 9th of Tammuz. And the second temple, they were breached on the 17th. And in general, the destruction of the second temple is considered, you know, more severe and more recent. So actually, the fast day was on the 17th of Tammuz. But the walls to Jerusalem were breached. So actually, the Mishnah says five events, and it goes in historical order. So the first event that happened on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz was Nishtabru Haluchos, that Moshe, when he descended the mountain and saw that the people were worshiping the golden calf, so he broke the tablets. And then we'll soon see why worshiping the golden calf was so terrible. The second event was the Korban Tamid, the daily sacrifice that was offered every day in the morning and the afternoon, was discontinued, that the local government would sell sheep to the Jews to provide them with materials for the sacrifice, and they discontinued selling it to them, so they were no longer able to continue with the daily sacrifice, which had been done really from the time that they were in the desert. And number three, and perhaps the most famous, was Hufka Ir, that the walls of Jerusalem were breached by the Romans. And in general, this is considered the primary reason for the fast, that perhaps if it was the other events, there wouldn't have necessarily been a fast day instituted. But this is really the most severe. And as we'll see, it's really opened up literally the gates for the destruction to happen. And number four is that the King Apostomus burned a Sefer Torah. And the fifth event that happens, and there's some dispute about whether it was in the period of the first or second temple, an idol was erected in the temple courtyard, also showing that our ability to serve Hashem in the temple was, even before it was destroyed, but was greatly interrupted. So looking at first event number one, which, and that's of the breaking of the tablets, which set the tone for subsequent events to happen. And that was the worshiping of the golden calf. So what was so terrible about worshiping the golden calf that it set the tone that that date would be a date that was really a negative omen for other tragedies to happen? So there's a big question about the worshiping of the golden calf, because they weren't, the general understanding is the Jewish people weren't building the calf to replace God or to worship it as an idol. If anything, it was considered more of an intermediary, that they thought that Moshe was gone and they decided to build the calf. And nevertheless, it was clearly a great error. And one of the things that was considered so tragic about it, it's partly described in Source 1 from the writings of Rav Aaron Cutler, who was the founding Rosh Yeshiva of the Lakewood Yeshivas, and now the largest yeshiva, at least outside of Israel. And he says really why it was so disappointing that it happened. He said that before the golden calf, having received the Torah on Mount Sinai, the Jewish people reached this stature of Adam HaRishon before his banishment from the Garden of Eden, that originally mankind was created in a very exalted level. Then when Adam and Chava ate from the tree of knowledge, so they declined spiritually. But when the Jewish people received the Torah, they were really restored to this level. And if they had not erred, both with the golden calf and later on with the spies, where they came back with a negative report, and that was on Tisha B'Av, and that really set the tone for the day for the rest of history. And had they not committed those errors, so they would have entered Eretz Yisrael at that time, and they would have enjoyed a supernatural existence with the open miracles like the ones that they experienced until now. And that furthermore, the temple would never have been destroyed, nor would the Jews have been exiled, with that, if not for the events of the worshiping of the golden calf and the negative report of the spies. And all these events were the outcome of the sin of the golden calf and the transgression of the spies. And it's a powerful thing that we see that sometimes a mistake, but also on the other side, a merit really doesn't only affect us, but affects future generations. And what's so tragic is that the Jewish people erred, maybe not even maliciously, but you know, were impatient to wait for Moshe to come down, and were too eager for a foreign type of spirituality, that mistake really impacted that date for the rest of history. And even more severe did the sin of the spies.
So because of the golden calf and because of the spies, they lost the first temple, both temples? Is that what you're saying?
So that was really what set the tone for the day. Now, we're told that both temples were destroyed in response to different transgressions on our part. The first temple was destroyed for murder, sexual immorality, and idolatry, and the second temple, the Gemara says, was destroyed because of sin aschinam, a baseless hatred. So it would seem that had we not made those mistakes at the time of the destructions, so the temples wouldn't have been destroyed. It's not like that just because those mistakes, the sin of the spies and the golden calf, that Hashem later on would inevitably have destroyed the temple. But because of the sins that we committed around the times of the destruction, those dates were sort of set as ones of negative omens. But I think it's only because we sinned later on that we were punished by the destruction of the temple.
Rabbi?
Yep. So the Mishnah tells us, but two, you look in the Torah. So the Torah says that in the you know, first month they left Egypt. It gives a timeline. We don't know necessarily that it was the 17th of Tammuz, but we sort of fit it in with the timeline that we can find in the Torah, and the Mishnah, the oral law, tells us that explicitly. And what the sin of the golden calf did was implicated the Jewish people as, you know, people who aren't loyal to Hashem and people who didn't act properly. You know, here the Jewish people are, we disclaim or we're told we're the chosen people, we believe in Hashem, we really go against the rest of the world, at least certainly the ancient world, on that front, that we didn't worship idolatry, we believe in one God, and here we are, and it was became known in our history that we worship something that at least had the appearances of an idol. And this is said in the verses describing the sin of the golden calf, when Aaron is reporting back to Moshe what happened, because Aaron, while he was trying to hold the people together, you know, to prevent them from acting worse, he still had a certain role in it. So Aaron's explaining, you know, what his role was. So he says that they told me, V'yomer li, I say, Lanu Elohim, Asher Yelchu Lifaneinu, that make us a God who will go before us. He said, Moshe, Aish, Asher, Elonim Eretz Yisrael, Lo Yadanu Maha Yalob. Because we don't know what happened to Moshe. But Omar Lahem, Lemizov, Hisparku, V'yitnu li, Hezlechego Be'esh, V'yitza, Egel Hazeh. And I said to them, who has gold? He's reporting what he did, and they removed it and gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and this calf came out. And then Moshe responds, V'yar Moshe es ha'am, ki baruahu, ki paro aron l'shimtza v'kamehem. That they saw Aaron had exposed their disgrace among those who rise up against him. That's how Rashi explains it. L'yos ha'davar azeh lignus b'fi kol ha'kamim aleihem. So in other words, the enemies of Israel will disgrace them by referring to the sin of the golden calf. That this was always, that this was something that, you know, we had on our record. And it really was a result of us not being patient and of us looking for spirituality in places that were inappropriate.
Rabbi, I also think that there must be something to do with the fact that this gold is what they were promised that they would leave Egypt with great riches. And this is the gold that the Egyptians gave them. And obviously, you know, by casting it back into the fire so that it would become an idol, it almost like it's an affront to Kodesh Baruch Hu, because he basically is, they're throwing back the promise that he made to them. And I don't think, you know, that would something be, obviously that would anger Hashem very much.
Right, especially they're using what he gave them improperly. And even if it wasn't meant to be idolatry, they still certainly weren't commanded to use it in that way. It certainly showed an impatience or lack of belief in the person who Hashem did designate to lead them. And yeah, it's I think it's a very good point that there's something more egregious about using something that someone gave you in a way that's improper towards them. I think absolutely. And more than the how Rashi explains that this would be something that would be on the Jews' record, so that the nations of the world will say, look, the Jews worshipped a god of gold, so to speak. The Ramban explains that it also had a negative, harmful influence on subsequent generations of Jews and on their belief. And I think that may address what Maggie was asking of, years later, you're telling me that they're going to be punished based on this. So I think the way the Ramban explains it is, it wasn't just that this was on the record and later on punishment was meted out, but that this created a negative influence on, you know, the Jews' perspective. So what the Ramban explains is that what would happen, that people will say that it was not in vain that our ancestors made the golden calf and worshipped it, for it was this calf that brought them out of Egypt. Since it was beneficial for them to worship the calf, we shall do the same, and it will also be good for us. People think, well, they...
Is there a common thing that, you know, there's a tradition that they didn't know where Yosef's bones were. Somebody threw something into the Nile, and up from the Nile drew Yosef's sarcophagus or his bones, and Yosef's sign was that of the shore.
Right.
The ox, which is somewhat like of a calf, I guess, an adult calf. And it's almost the same kind of language that you find in that. I think it's a mission or a midrash that came this from.
There may be. It's an interesting point. I'm not aware of any connection between that and Yosef, but there very well could be. So the problem was that people will think, and it shows that you have to be careful with your actions. So these people, even if they thought that it was just an intermediary or just to replace Moshe or some sort of spiritual device, the fact of the matter is, subsequent generations, you know, wouldn't necessarily understand the nuance, and they'll say, oh, well, our ancestors are to worship the calf in whatever capacity, so let's also build a calf and worship it. And he says that this was, in fact, what was said at the time of Yeruvim, the evil king of the northern kingdom, who made two golden calves, who said to the people, it is too far to go to the temple in Jerusalem. These are your gods that you brought up from the land of Egypt. In a very similar language that's used in Shmos. So Moshe foresaw prophetically how the golden calf would be the cause of transgression for generations. So it wasn't necessarily that this was something, this was a black mark on a record, and you know, little by little we were punished later on in history, but It was a bad precedent. It was a harmful precedent that they created this type of deity or item of worship, and that was something that really forever, at least, influenced the subsequent generations to think, well, maybe there's some legitimacy in, you know, making an idol or worshiping it, and this was why Moshe Rabbeinu was so upset about it, why he broke the luchos, the tablets, which the Rashi in the Torah tells us that the original Yashar Koach, Hashem gives Moshe a Yashar Koach for breaking the luchos, which indicates that Hashem was pleased or approved of that decision. And this really emphasized, why was Moshe so upset about this? And the Ramban says here that Ral Moshe Kiladoros Yivshuvo, that Moshe saw that this would be something that for generations the people would look back on and maybe use as a precedent for worshiping actual idolatry. And
sorry.
Yep. So at that point, the people heard the first two commandments. There's a question in the commentaries if they actually heard all 10, but at least according to the simple reading, they heard the first two commandments, then Moshe went up and got the rest of the Torah.
Okay, so, and it says it in the second commandment, right?
Lo yelecha, right. Right, so it was clearly a transgression. The question is, what was the nature of the transgression? That it may not have been, or probably wasn't, an actual idolatry in the sense that they rejected God and were worshiping this as an independent deity. But it was certainly forbidden. And Chenoch Leibowitz, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva, so he expands upon the Ramban, who says that the issue was that later generations would look back to this and use it as a precedent. He says one can explain from the words of Ramban, who cites the Targum, that the transgression of the golden calf impacted the Jewish people to worship idols in the days of Yeravam ben Nevat and for generations after him. Even though the Jewish people did not worship this calf for one full day, and the calf itself was immediately burned up and pulverized. Meaning the question you can ask is, what do you mean this was a precedent? It ended up being destroyed. How are people going to go back and say, oh, look, our ancestors worshiped the calf, and we can do the same? As it says, and they no longer worship it. Nevertheless, the serious transgression caused future generations to stumble and commit serious transgressions. There's not an unusual consequence because it's the nature of historical events to have future consequences. So even though it was may not have been idolatry and was, you know, short-lived, the fact is it planted something in the, you know, psyche of the Jewish people that this was something that at least a corrupt king like Yeravam ben Nevat, okay, maybe people who were, you know, more pious and wise and realized that this was improper, but that someone could come and point to, and it really made this imprint. And for that reason, it was something that was so terrible. And as we started out with, the Mishnah says the five occurrences that we fast for on the 17th of Tammuz, so the breaking of the tablets, the sacrifices, the breach of the walls, the burning of the Sefer Torah, and putting an idol in the temple courtyard. So, back to Maggie's question about that this was done in one generation and then later tragic events happened on those dates. So source number 7 says the breaking of the tablets defined the 17th of Tammuz. It forged the eternal nature of this date and the tragedies that occurred in subsequent generations on the 17th of Tammuz all necessarily flow from this defining moment. And we'll see how. With a little study, it is not difficult to see how later events are merely different expressions of the original breaking of the tablets on this day. Each one of these episodes demonstrates a disintegration of the bond between God and Israel, a direct consequence of the breaking of the tablets at Sinai. This is a biblical, so now this is going to connect the other events to the building of the calf and showing how essentially they're very similar. So the biblical description of the daily offering explicitly states that this practice began at Sinai. The constant offering, the Korban Tamid, is parenthetically, in this week's Toronto Torah, I have the Parsha article discussing the Korban Tamid. So just a plug for that, shameless self-promotion. So the termination of this offering on the 17th of Tammuz was the end of a daily practice that had begun in Mount Sinai and continued without interruption for centuries. Despite the travel of the Jews in the desert and the wandering of the tabernacle in the newly conquered land of Israel and the occupation of the enemy, this sacrifice had been a constant, right? Every day, twice a day, this has been offered. And it offered the nation a daily opportunity to present something tangible to God. It was a very real and meaningful expression of their relationship with God. And it was something that was done on a regular basis. You know, so it showed that the connection to God was never interrupted. And it was something that was demonstrable. But like the tablets before it, the daily offering and the relationship it represented came to an end on the 17th of Tammuz. And the connection between the breaking of the tablets and the burning of the Torah scrolls is straightforward. The Torah scroll is the divine document that communicates God's instructions to his people. A public burning of a Torah represents a breakdown of the Jewish people's connection with the Sinai experience. For other nations to impose their paganism on the Jewish nation is to be expected, but for King of Yehuda, who some understand as being King Manasseh, the wicked king of Israel, to profane God's temple with an idol is another demonstration that the nation's connection to Sinai continued to disintegrate. And then finally, we have the breach of the walls of Jerusalem, which for three times a year, the nation would make a pilgrimage there. And therefore, once that was breached, I mean, the walls made it a contained area, a special area. But once the walls were breached, so it was only a matter of time until the temple would be destroyed. And that's what happened. Once the enemy came in, so then it was only 3 weeks later that they were able to burn the temple entirely. But he continues that this breach was not merely a physical event. The walls of Jerusalem symbolized the unity of the nation, and a breach in the walls therefore symbolized a breach in national unity. So this was a time when all Jews would enter the city by way of the gates, and the nation would live together within the city walls. So now this was no longer possible. And at Sinai, the Jews stood at the mountain as one nation, like one person with one heart, Ish Echad Lev Echad. Unity was a prerequisite for receiving the Ten Commandments. So a breach in the walls of Jerusalem thus represents a further departure from Sinai. So you see how these events are similar, that there is first a certain severance with the Torah and leading to, you know, both a physical threat, but really losing the lofty level that we gained really with the Sinai experience. So that's really the Shivasar B'Tammuz, that it started out with the breaking of the tablets, which we in response to the golden calf, and then most notably the walls of Jerusalem being breached, burning a Sefer Torah, and was really the 17th of Tammuz is, I think, in some ways a little more, I'm just thinking about it now, in some ways a little more tragic than maybe even Tisha B'Av, because sometimes seeing things decline may be in some ways more difficult than actually seeing the final destruction. There was a powerful speaker, Rabbi Levi Greenspan. He went blind in his 20s, I think he had glaucoma, and he said the process of losing his sight was to him more frightening than when he actually lost it. That it's something that you know is going to happen, that's something that was that's unfolding, and you know that when it happens without really any ability to control it, it's something that's painful in very significant ways. And that's really what happened on Shivasar B'Tammuz, that the walls were breached. And then you can only imagine what people were thinking, that the first temple, the Babylonians came in, and then it was the Romans. They're already in the city. It's only going to be a matter of time until the temple is destroyed, and the question really is when. And that's something that the 17th of Tammuz began that tragic process. But we spend this period mourning the destruction of the temple. And the question is, it was something that happened many years ago, almost 2,000 years ago. So why are we mourning the temple? Why does it matter so much to us?
Don't you think it's only fair that if we honor happy times, Purim and Hanukkah, that we should also honor those sad times?
So you're saying more honor it in remembrance, meaning to say we should remember it, or are you saying it's something that's current?
No, we should, well, actually maybe both. Remember it and also be sad that it hasn't been rebuilt.
Uh-huh, so certainly remembering it, you know, certainly appropriate to remember things that, both happy things and unfortunately sad things that happened in the past so we don't forget it, and looking forward to its being rebuilt, but especially with the second point, so what are we lacking right now? Why do we want it to be rebuilt?
I think it means the absence of Yerushalayim as the centrality of the Jewish people. Once we no longer have the Ben Mikdash there, I mean, essentially, it's harder to keep the Jewish people unified in one location.
So really emphasizing the point of national unity, that now we're scattered about, but when the temple's there, there's something that brings us together. And that was certainly a part of it, and it's something that I just saw was part of the symbolism of the breaching of the wall, that then it no longer became a confined area that could really bring Jews together. So there are a couple of different aspects to the destruction of the temple and what's missing without it. So there's a stirring medrash in Eicha, or about Echa, Lamentations. And it said when they burned the Beis HaMikdash, the Holy One, blessed be He, said, I no longer have a resting place in the land. It is no longer mine, rather I will remove my presence from it. Salak Shkinasi Mimena, I will remove my Shechina from it. So the Shechina is a certain manifestation of the presence of Hashem, a certain protective manifestation, and when the temple was burned, so Hashem removed that from that place. Interesting, the Rambam says, to some extent, the Shechina ain't a betela. There's still a Shechina in Yerushalayim and in the site of the Beis HaMikdash, but at least it was its presence was diminished, and we no longer have that, and we'll see that in certain ways, more tangible manifestation of God's presence. And this next source shows sort of what Steve was saying, the centrality of the temple in the Jewish people as a whole. It says in source 9, the temple was where every Jew, no matter what his situation, could meet God. God did not want to be far away. He wanted to be next to his people, and he wanted them to partake of his goodness. And Victor Miller explains that the temple was not merely a place of prayer and service, but was actually the dwelling place of God. You know, kivyachol, Hashem isn't physical, but however we're supposed to understand it, it was like the home of, called the Bayit, it was like the home of Hashem. He writes that it was a stunning declaration of the principle that God's interest is not in the vast distances of space and the millions of star worlds, but in man alone. There's a certain dwelling place in this world. And the idea is alluded to in Asuli Mikdash V'Shachanti B'Socham, that shall make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell inside of them. The commentaries point out that the verse does not say I will dwell inside it, but rather inside them. Meaning that temple was such a powerful reality that inspired the Almighty's presence to dwell inside each and every Jew. That it was something that the people, one was the central place that they could go, but it was really in the heart of every Jew. It was something that was fueling them and was constantly inspiring them. And that was possible because there was this greater manifestation of Hashem in the temple in Yerushalayim. And it was and with this there was greater indication that Hashem, we know Hashem runs the world, is involved in the world, but it can be, we're living in a time of what we call Hester Panit, when Hashem's face is hidden. So we still can see ways that Hashem is involved, but sometimes the reality is that it's less apparent. And when it's less apparent, believing in Hashem and trusting in Hashem is much more difficult. But now the question is, okay, it's been a long time since the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and a lot of other tragedies have happened in our history. So why every year, why are we so focused on the temple? One, of mourning the temple, but also it's so much a part of our worldview. In our davening, we mentioned the temple. I once heard someone say that if we didn't have the belief in the coming of Mashiach and the rebuilding of the temple, so how would anyone ever end the Dvar Torah? You know, the fact that we do that, it's so central to our world. But why are we so stuck on it? So this is something that apparently Plato asked Yirmiyahu. It describes that when Yirmiyahu saw the temple in ruins, he fell on the bricks and mortar and cried. And Plato, the Greek philosopher, came up to him and exclaimed, "How can you, the wisest of the Jews, cry over bricks and mortar? And why are you crying over the past? What happened, happened." And Plato continued, "The wise person doesn't cry over the past, but for the future." The Yirmiyahu replied, "You are a great philosopher. Surely you must have some philosophical quandaries." Plato said to him, "I do have questions, but I don't think there's anyone who can answer them." So Yirmiyahu said, "Ask me and I will answer you." So Plato asked, and Yirmiyahu answered all of Plato's philosophical questions. And Plato was so astonished at his profound wisdom that he was not sure whether Yirmiyahu was really a man or an angel. Meaning, here was this person who he thought was, you know, acting like a fool. But here Plato sees that he's the, you know, greatest, he can answer all of his philosophical quandaries. So then, so then the question is, why was he, you know, why was he crying over what Plato thought was just the bricks and mortar? So Yirmiyahu then said to Plato, all of this wisdom has come from these bricks and mortar. As for why I'm crying over the past, I will not answer you, since you will not be able to comprehend it. Only a Jew can understand the depth of crying over the past. And I think that there are two points here. One, there's an indication that the Beis HaMikdash was a source of some wisdom. And we can see that from what we say, Shebane Beis HaMikdash Mehera V'Yameinu, that the Beis HaMikdash should be built speedily in our days, V'ten Chalkeinu B'Torahtecha, give us a portion in your Torah. That without the Beis HaMikdash, our ability to understand Torah is lessened. And, you know, there's several places that indicate this. One is that we're told that the Sanhedrin discontinued capital punishment with whatever frequency it was meted out 40 years before the destruction of the temple, because already, in order to decide capital cases, there needs to be, you know, profound wisdom and extraordinary wisdom and heavenly help. When they realized that this was diminished, so then they could no longer delve into these types of matters. So there is an idea that Yirmiyahu is expressing to Plato that his wisdom came from the temple, and that in a more metaphysical way, the temple was a source of wisdom.
Right, there's a similar story of Napoleon when he was visiting Jerusalem. He walked by a synagogue and heard on Tisha B'Av, and he heard Jews crying and wailing. And he said, "Why are they doing this?" Because he had a Jewish guide with him. He said, "Well, they're mourning the loss of the temple." He said, "Well, if they are mourn for that 1,000 years later, or whatever." 1,500 years after, they're likely to happen again.
Right, that's a very powerful story. But the same question may be, and Napoleon was very interesting. He was kind of a philo-Semite in some ways, and though perhaps he wanted to more secularize the Jews, but he had a certain Sanhedrin. So the question is, the question was, a wise man doesn't cry over the past, but builds the future. Right, so Adam Chacham lo bocha ala avar, ela bona ala asid. Right, so I guess it's sort of like living in the past. They should, you know, don't cry on what you've lost, just worry about the future. You know, no point on dwelling in the past. That's what Plato was telling him. And this point is valid, that you don't want to live entirely in the past. But Yirmiyahu is telling him, one, the wisdom I have came from these bricks and mortar. The presence of the Beis HaMikdash provided or fostered wisdom in the world. And as for why I'm crying over the past, I mean, why am I stuck in the past? Only a Jew can understand this. And like Stephen was saying with the story about Napoleon, it seems to have been something that Napoleon was surprised by. And he must have seen other, he had his own religion, he must have seen other religions. But to see that there are people, that the Jews, so many years later, were still crying over the past, maybe it is something that only a Jew can understand. Why we do have this connection to the past. Maybe because our past entirely influences our future and our present. Another aspect that the temple provided was joy in the world. And the Mishnah says, "Kol mi shelo ra'a simchas beis ha-shoeva, lo ra'a simcha miyamav." That whoever didn't witness the simchas beis ha-shoeva, the water drawing festival, on Chol HaMoed Sukkos, in times of the Beis HaMikdash, when we're told that there would be jugglers and there would be fantastic celebrations, and whoever didn't witness this has never experience, the translation says true joy, but actually just says just simcha, who's never really had joy. And is it just the presence of the Beis HaMikdash and the simcha that was involved in being involved in the mitzvos that we were able to do there was something that's extraordinary and something that we haven't aren't able to replicate. And not only that, there are some practices the rabbis instituted that in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, so we do try to curtail our joy, even on festive occasions. Probably the most famous one is breaking a glass at a wedding. That, one, we don't have the ability to have the type of joy just because it's not available, and two, we are supposed to limit our joy proactively because we don't have, because we're not able to serve Hashem in the way that we would like to.
It's more than that, Rabbi. We're not able to serve Hashem the way Hashem wanted us to serve Him.
Excellent. I think you said it much better. That's true, that we're not able to do His will. Hashem wants us, so to speak, to be able to do all of the mitzvahs. Now we're not able to do but more than half of the mitzvahs and of the 613 mitzvahs. So Hashem wants us to be exactly. I agree that we're not able to serve Hashem in the way that He wants us to serve Him. And of course, we would like to serve Hashem in the best possible way.
So that's probably the reason, really, why we mourn its destruction.
Right, that we're not able to, right now, our service of Hashem is essentially inadequate, meaning we do the best we can under our circumstances, but we always talk about how the Torah is 613 mitzvos, but there are so many mitzvos we're not able to do. Even some of the mitzvos that are related to the land of Israel, which now, thank God, we have more of an opportunity to do, are rabbinic in the absence of the temple, there's the majority of the Jewish people living in Israel. So absolutely. Another thing we're losing in the absence of the temple is the ability for our prayers to be as effective. And the idea that the temple served as a place where the prayers rose more directly to heaven is found in the verse in Bereishis describing Yaakov. And Yaakov went to sleep. He said how inspiring this place is. Or Manora Makom Hazet Eidakim Beis Elokim Zet Shar Hashemayim. That this is the must be God's house. That this was the site that the Beis Hamikdash would be built on, and it's the gate to heaven. I mean, their prayers went straight up. However, that's meant to be understood, it was easier for prayers to be effective. And in the absence of the temple, so there is a certain barrier between us and Hashem when praying. The Gemara in Brachos in Source 13 says, Yom Shachar Beis HaMikdash Nalo Shari Tvila Shenemar Gami Azak God that even as I cry out and plead, He shut out my prayer. It's a verse from Eicha, that its prayers are harder to, our prayers are more difficult for our prayers to reach heaven. Of course, we still do pray, and of course, it's still possible for our, and Hashem does, of course, listen to every word of our prayers, but it's still, it can be more difficult without, with this channel has been blocked up to some degree. But the Gemara says in Source 14 above Metziah, Vafabli Shashari Tzfila Ninalo Shari Demos Lo Ninalo, that even though the gates of prayer have been sealed, the gates of tears have not been sealed. That is when someone prays with great emotion, even to the point of crying, so that's something that will go up to Shemayim, even in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash. So it shows we have to work harder, and we have the privilege to, to have that experience. Maybe we're able to grow even more that way. But nevertheless, we have to work much harder for our prayers to be effective. Another way that we're lacking Hashem's direct presence in the world is really in as seeing Hashem's present directly in terms of, you know, miracles. You know, when you would see miracle, when a person would see miracles every day, so then it would be easier for them to, you know, really believe in Hashem and know that Hashem is there. So the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says there were 10 wonders that were performed for our ancestors in the temple. No woman miscarried from the aroma of the sacrificial meat. The sacrificial meat never became putrid. No fly was seen in the place where the meat was cut up. Never did a seminal emission occur to the high priest on Yom Kippur. The rains didn't extinguish the fire on the wood pyre of the altar, right? It would go straight up. The wind didn't disperse the vertical column of the smoke from the altar. No disqualification was found in the Omer, or the Lechem, Shteya Lechem, or the Lechem upon him, the two loaves or the showbread. The people stood crowded together, yet prostrated themselves with wide spaces between them, right? The entire Jewish people were in Yerushalayim, or in the area of the Beis HaMikdash on the three pilgrimage festivals. So it must have been very crowded. But the miracle happened that they were able to prostrate even though there was limited room. It says, they never did a snake or scorpion injure someone in Yerushalayim. No man said to his friend, there's no room for me to sleep overnight in Jerusalem. So there were all these extraordinary things that happened during the times of the temple that then when the temple was destroyed, we no longer have. Also, the Talmud Yerushalmi indicates that there was a level of protection that happened. You know, sometimes you forget to lock your car, you forget to lock your house, so you leave, you go on your trip to Yerushalayim for the pilgrimage festival, you're on your plane there, and you think, oh, I forgot to lock my door. Someone may be trying to break in. So we're told of a story that during one of the pilgrimage festivals, one of the travelers to the temple in Yerushalayim left his wheat unguarded in his field. Upon his return, he found lions surrounding and guarding it. Another traveler left his chicken pens unguarded, and upon his return, found cats ripped apart near them. Another traveler left his home unlocked, and upon his return, found a snake curled around the lock guarding it. Right, it's pretty good, a security system. And another incident where Pinchas recounted the following incident. Two brothers who resided in Ashkelon had non-Jewish neighbors. These neighbors plotted to take advantage of the brothers' ritual ascent to Jerusalem in order to plunder the belongings they had left behind. After the brothers departed on their journey, God sent angels to live in their home. When the brothers returned after the holiday, the Gentiles asked them, "Where have you been?" They replied, "In Jerusalem." They asked, "Who did you leave behind in your home?" They answered, "No one." Having grasped the miracle performed by, there was a miracle performed by God, the Gentile exclaimed, "Blessed is the God of the Jews who does not abandon them and surely will never abandon them in the future." So there were these miracles, but we see here, more importantly, there's a great Kiddush Hashem. The great Kiddush Hashem when the nations of the world recognize God's providence over the Jewish people. And that's one of the tragedies of destruction, the Zechilah Hashem, a desecration of God's name, when people will ask, "Where is Hashem?" You know, that's the ultimate desecration of God's name. They think Hashem has abandoned his people and is no longer active in the world. But during the times of the temple, even the non-Jewish neighbors will see, wow, these Jews go up to their pilgrimage festivals to Jerusalem, and they come back, there's a snake guarding their door, there's angels in their house. Clearly Hashem is involved with them, and Hashem is protecting them. And that's a great Kiddush Hashem that happened on a regular basis. All right. While at least now we're scheduled to fast tomorrow, and Tisha B'Av as a fast day, is still on the schedule, but hopefully this year, and I think hopefully learning this will, we want to strengthen our belief that this is the case, that this year we'll be able to celebrate the words of the prophet Zechariah, Kom Hashem Tzvakos, Tzom Ha'Aviv, Tzom Ha'Chamishi, Tzom Ha'Shvi, the fast of the fourth month, the fifth month, the seventh month, Tzom Ha'Siri, and of the tenth month, Yed Lebez Yehuda, L'Sasun, L'Simcha, L'Moadim Tovim, Emes Ha'Shalom Ha'Avio, that the fast of all the fast days shall be for the house of Yehuda, for joy, happiness, and for festivities, only love, truth, and peace. So hopefully that will be, we'll be able to experience it this year. and to try to, especially in during the 3 weeks where we observe some morning rituals, we're not getting a haircut or shaving or listening to music, having weddings, whatever it may be. But really remember why we're doing it, why we're mourning, what we now lack, and what we have to look forward to.